Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
Now to the food fight over a popular condiment.
David Chang's Momofuku Chili Crunch.
A spicy showdown. A fight now sizzling.
They're calling him even a trademark bully.
This stuff has been a staple in a lot of Asian kitchens for generations.
Ancient Chinese condiment or protected trademark. Momofuku's fight for Chili Crunch. That's coming up on Day 6. Today, China's not-so-secret weapon.
You are really under the party's control.
How WeChat could tip the scales in Canada's elections. America broken down.
You feel like you've been dropped into a war zone and your pulse rate will increase.
Alex Garland's Civil War brings the mayhem, but should you watch it? And the book America Loves to Ban.
I started to see challenge after challenge after challenge after challenge.
The author of Gender Queer on Why the Book Endures. All today on Day 6, the Listen to the Banned edition.
So you'll find in my house when I use Chili Crunch, I almost always get to the bottom and there's no more oil on top. That's not a default. That's just how I like. I love using the oil to cook. That's why it's nice having a brand new jar.
Oh yeah, nothing like a brand new jar of Chili Crunch. I mean, it goes on everything. Eggs, noodles, ice cream. The basic idea is oil, chilies, and crispy fried garlic or other alliums. There are lots of different versions out there. The guy we just heard is celebrity chef David Chang. His company, Momofuku, sells a version of Chili Crunch. And recently, the company applied to trademark the name. It also sent out cease and desist letters to other companies that make their own versions. And that did not go over well. There was a ton of backlash. Then, on Friday evening, David Chang and Momofuku backed down, saying the company will not enforce its trademark on Chili Crunch. Michelle Tiu is the owner of Homaya. She got one of those cease and desist letters about her product, Sambal Chili Crunch. I spoke to her before Momofuku announced it was backing down. What was it like to receive that cease and desist letter from Momofuku?
Well, honestly, I was a little incredulous at first. When I first opened the letter, I don't think I realized it. It was, you know, a legal letter. I kind of just saw Momofuku on it. And then when I read through it, I think I felt a sense of betrayal, to be honest, because David Chang's a really, really big figure in the Asian/Asian-American community here, especially in New York City and especially as a food and beverage founder. And, you know, I think I was just really surprised that after over a decade of personally supporting David Chang and Momofuku and their various restaurants and pantry goods, and that the first communication I would receive as, you know, also a food and beverage Asian American business owner was a legal letter and a legal threat. That was quite a sad day.
And how threatening was the letter? What did they say?
Yeah, so it was basically very clearly written. They were requesting that we, Hamaya, cease the use of the Chili Crunch mark, or in other words, you know, stop selling a Chili Crunch item in 90 days. That we agree not to incorporate any components of Chili Crunch in any of our future products or to apply or register the trademark, and that we would have 5 business days to respond confirming that we would comply to those requests. If not, there might be a need for legal proceedings. In other words, that they would sue us for infringement.
You decided that you weren't going to comply, though. Why did you make that decision?
Well, it wasn't an immediate decision. To be honest, I think the first thing I did think was, what can I do now? Like, the product's on the market, I have contracts on there. But, you know, I started thinking through what the alternative names would be. You know, that's obviously, as a small business owner that knows that I can't fight back in court because of just the resource and power imbalance. That's the first thing you think of. But right. then my husband actually encouraged me and was like, hey, you know, you have the benefit and the privileges of being well-educated. You have contacts in the community. So I thought about that, and then I reached out to folks. I would just Google randomly, and anyone with the name Chili Crunch, I would just send an email to their customer service being like, hey, just wondered if you received any unusual letters from the company Momofuku recently. And a majority of them responded, yes, that they did. And what really shocked me in their response, that more than half of the respondents replied that they had already responded to Momofuku apologizing, or that they were intending to in a few days, because, you know, number one, they were frightened. But number two, a lot of them didn't actually realize that Momofuku doesn't even own the Chili Crunch trademark with the I. At that time, they hadn't even applied when the letter was sent out. So it was a preemptive action. Mm. And so I realized quickly that this would be an incredibly successful strategy for Momofuku, you know, just send out a bunch of cease and desist in a simple letter campaign, and all the small mom and pops would most certainly comply immediately, as you know, as evidence. And then it was really up to me at that point. It suddenly felt bigger than me, you know, that it felt that if I rolled over too immediately in those few days, that I had done a disservice basically to the community, to the cuisine and people I was trying to represent in what I did. And so that was when I decided to, you know, take a risk. And I responded in a negative, saying that I don't believe that they have a right to this very kind of generic and descriptive trademark, that businesses like me and these other mom and pops, we should be able to describe the products that we were selling that were based on our family recipes often and part of our culture. We should mm-hmm. be able to use the word descriptively. So that's the gist yeah. of it.
Let's talk about the personal connection that you have with your product, Sambal mm-hmm. Chili Crunch. It was created independently of Momofuku's product, obviously. But I sense there's a story behind it, that it's connected to you in a way that's deeper than just a product.
Yeah, I think all of us have are very connected to the foods of our childhood. And for me, sambal is just like something I really had almost every day. My grandmother, Noni, she was a really well-known cook from the region of like Penang, Malaysia. And so it was just something that I grew up eating. And every family has their version of sambal. There are like thousands of varieties. So I just kind of took this specifically Penang, Malaysian, and then, you know, my grandmother's version of it, and brought it over to the U.S. and mm-hmm. eventually decided to jar it, you know, when I started the company, and initially sold it as sambal. And a lot of the folks would like purchase it and tell me like, hey, like this isn't sambal. This is like Chili Crunch. It's something else. And so that was when mm-hmm. I learned that the American kind of audience here, like they had specific understandings of what a sambal man or what a Chili Crunch man. And eventually it was really the consumer that named the product Sambal Chili Crunch. And so we switched out the labels for those.
So beyond your business, what are the broader implications of trademarking the name Chili Crunch? What do you think?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I mean, there have been a lot of thoughts on this, but I think the most important takeaway we have is the corporate mechanism unfortunately favors the bigger companies that have built a certain kind of sophistication in their finances, you know, in their legal. And it's quite against, you know, that simple kind of story of the small mom and pop, of the immigrant business owner, which really are kind of the true original owners, you know, of that kind of Chili Crunch, Chili Crisp, all of these sort of condiments. So my understanding is that trademark law is really something that was meant to even protect fair competition. But I think that in this case with Chili Crunch, it's actually the opposite, because, you know, using trademark law, like larger companies eventually become monopolies of these products.
Will you be able to enjoy products or food or restaurants from Momofuku? How does it affect the way that you now may or may not consume their products?
I admit that I probably will not be purchasing Momofuku's Chili Crunch products, you know, anytime soon personally myself. I think it definitely leaves a little bit of a bitter taste to be confronted with that. But you know, the world is small, and in terms of Momofuku personally, if the Momofuku team were to reach out and be amiable to showing that they want to make amends to the community as a whole, I don't want to say that it's something that's beyond redemption, or that, you know, I'm a permanent enemy of the company. Like, I think this is just something that, you know, I just want to sell my sauces and I want the community to grow.
What's your favorite thing to put chili crunch on?
Actually, just a fried egg on a bowl of rice. It's just something that, you know, if I don't want to cook and I just don't have anything else in the fridge, you know, a bowl of rice, an egg, and some chili crunch, and, you know, you're all set for the day.
Sounds yummy. Have you tried it on ice cream?
I have tried it on ice cream before. It is also very good on ice cream, on vanilla ice cream.
Michelle Tieu, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. It's been a lovely conversation.
Michelle Tieu is the owner of Homaya, a business selling Malaysian culinary products, including sambal chili crunch. I spoke to her before Momofuku announced that it will not enforce its trademark on chili crunch. Here are some other stories we're keeping an eye on this weekend.
With the heat and dryness across the country, we can expect that the wildfire season will start sooner and end later and potentially be more explosive.
And yes, that might mean even worse than last year. This week, Canadian officials sounded the alarm over the upcoming wildfire season. Last year's season was Canada's worst ever. 15 million hectares were burnt, roughly seven times the annual average. Nearly 250,000 people were displaced. Eight firefighters died battling the wildfires. This year, extreme drought conditions in BC, southern Alberta, and southern Ontario are expected to make things worse. Climate change and rising global temperatures are contributing factors. And pressure is mounting on the federal government over a lack of judges across the country. Two child sexual assault cases at Toronto Superior Court were recently thrown out and charges were stayed against the accused due to a lack of judges to try the cases. Ontario Superior Court Justice Michael Code called that an embarrassment to the administration of justice. There are currently at least 65 judicial vacancies across Canada. This week, the American Library Association released a list of the most challenged books of 2023. It highlights the books that are most targeted for censorship and book bans in libraries and schools in the U.S. More than half of the books on the list have queer characters or authors. And at the very top of the list is Genderqueer, a Memoir. It's a graphic novel by Maya Kobabe about navigating gender identity as a child and teenager. So we asked Maya to tell us about having the most challenged book for 3 years in a row.
This is Maya Kobabe, and I'm the author of Genderqueer, a Memoir, which is an autobiography about my own experiences coming out as non-binary. I have always used art as a way to kind of process my own feelings and thoughts and experiences in the world. But I really had shied away from making any comics or art about gender for a long time. And when I finally sat down, it was out of frustration because I had been trying to come out and trying to start using non-binary pronouns. And it just felt very hard to ask for. It felt hard to start that conversation. It felt hard to explain why it was important to me. And out of frustration, I was like, I just have to make art about this. I just have to write about it. And maybe if I write about it, I can figure out a way to explain it to other people. Almost immediately, as soon as the book was published, which was about 5 years ago in May of 2019, I started to get really powerful, wonderful reader responses. I had people messaging me things like, your story is my story also. Some of the memories you talk about could almost be my memories from my diary. And it made me feel less alone as the author of the book in the same way that it made the readers feel less alone as the readers of the book. For the first 2 years it was out, it was selling well, but it wasn't making headlines and it wasn't a bestseller. It was just sort of a medium successful book from a debut author from a small publisher. And I was very happy with that. And then the book challenges started. The first ones I heard about were, you know, a couple challenges in different school districts. And then there was one in Virginia that got filmed and kind of went viral on social media. And that one seemed to be the inciting incident of like a huge domino effect of copycat challenges. A lot of the people who challenged the book proudly say that they have not read it. And I think if people read it, you will see that is the story of coming of age, is the story of coming out, is the story about identity and about family and personal growth. It is not the salacious volume that it is being painted in certain parts of the media. It's just very strange to have, you know, some of the most conservative politicians in my country, like, literally hold my book up and say, this is exactly the kind of book we don't want in schools. And sometimes I almost think I do have to compartmentalize and almost forget that it is a book that I wrote about myself. Otherwise, it will just feel too sort of infuriating that people are challenging and dismissing what is my lived experience and saying that this is not appropriate for young people when the majority of the book is about myself as a young person. Many queer young people who are born into families that don't have an out queer family member or don't have a queer mentor like at school or in some other part of their community might have almost no way to find out things about their own identity, their own health, their own future, their own relationships, their body, their sexuality, except through, you know, library books, Google searches, TV, media, etc. And browsing through a library and maybe finding a queer book and reading it on the shelf without even bringing it home can be one of the sort of safest and most important ways to find out this really important stuff about who they are. Removing the possibility of queer young people just browsing and coming across queer books in the library is cutting off a huge lifeline for young people who might be quite vulnerable and quite isolated otherwise. When other young people come to me, you know, expressing some confusion or questions about their identity, especially if they're in a situation where the adults in their life are not listening to them and not respecting who they are, I usually say, you are the expert on your own identity. No one can tell you who you are. You are the one who knows who you are. And even if people around you are not seeing that and not acknowledging it right now, it doesn't change who you are. And if it isn't safe for you to come out, know that not being out doesn't change who you are and it doesn't make you less and it doesn't make you a coward. Sometimes it actually makes you brave and it makes you smart. Just keep doing the things that you love, make music, write poetry, and a time will come when you can be out and you can be yourself and you can find people who will love you and support you and see you for who you are.
Maya Kobabe is the author of Gender Queer, a memoir. It has topped the American Library Association's list of books most targeted for censorship and banning for the past 3 years. Still to come on Day 6, America is divided by civil war in Alex Garland's visceral and weirdly apolitical new movie. It's a talker, but should you watch it?
I learned I was the target of a disinformation campaign in May of this year on the Chinese language social media platform WeChat. The Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs concluded that Beijing's role in this disinformation operation was highly probable.
That is Conservative MP Michael Chong testifying at a U.S. congressional hearing on foreign interference. That was in September of last year. Chong is among those testifying at the ongoing public inquiry into alleged foreign interference in Canada. WeChat, the messaging and social media platform where the campaign against Chong started, has now been banned on all federal government-issued devices. But unlike TikTok, it hasn't come under much public scrutiny. And Seth Kaplan thinks that it's time for that to change. Seth Kaplan is a professorial lecturer at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Good morning, Seth. Welcome to Day 6.
My pleasure to join you today.
There's been a lot of talk about whether we should be worried about TikTok. And you say the dangers around WeChat are worse than the risk posed by TikTok. Why is that?
Well, I'm not saying that TikTok isn't a worry, but everything we worry about on TikTok is already happening on WeChat, whether it's management of information, promotion of certain narratives, basically expelling or or making not possible to see certain people because the party, the Chinese Communist Party, doesn't like the content. Every single thing that we worry about on TikTok is happening on WeChat, and it's happening on a daily basis.
Give us some idea of how central WeChat is to the Chinese diaspora in countries like Australia, the US, and Canada.
For those whose primary language is Chinese, especially from the mainland, it's hugely important. When we say the Chinese diaspora, we have to think there's people from Taiwan, there's people from Hong Kong, and those are less likely to be dependent upon WeChat. There's also people who might be second generation, grow up in an English-speaking environment and don't have strong ties to mainland China. It's less important. But for the millions of people in the United States and Canada who are students, who are recent immigrants, who are still using Chinese language on a regular basis, WeChat is hugely important, not only for communicating with each other, but from everything from ordering a car to taking photographs to paying bills, to everything that people can imagine that we use on several apps, they're using one app for all of it.
You've been monitoring WeChat groups that were formed in the United States by Americans, sometimes Chinese Americans, and you have evidence of interference from the Chinese government. Give us some examples of that.
Everybody who uses it is conscious of what is going on. It's hard to avoid it. And the evidence is that the party promotes certain narratives. The party favors certain facts, should we say. And if there's anyone posting, especially if they begin to have some sort of followership or people who are reading, or you're in some large audience group, and they say things that are opposed to that narrative. Let's give some examples. Let's suppose you went on WeChat, and I'm speaking of a person I know and a person who I've spent a lot of time talking with, and she didn't want to say anything against the party because you know that was a no-go area, but she wanted to say things about the positive experience she was having as an immigrant in the United States. And she had lots of people who are beginning to pay attention to her content. That became no-go. She got suspended. Her account got shut down. Her content, when it was still active, a lot of things became not available. People could not see her content. It would be disallowed. And even if it was allowed, it would be demoted on the algorithm. Because the way WeChat manages information is that if they don't like your content, they can simply not promote it so no one sees it. Mm-hmm. They can redline your content so it's not available at all, or they can simply suspend your account and not allow you to post anything. So they have lots and lots of tools to manage information that they don't like.
As you probably know, the Chinese government has denied taking any actions in Canada that would influence the elections, but it sounds like the kinds of things you're describing and the management of information, the censorship, this is being done quite openly. How much responsibility does the party actually take for the management or for interfering with WeChat accounts?
Well, first we have to understand that WeChat is so central to the Chinese language information ecosystem that through WeChat, the party can also manage newspapers, can influence newspapers, can influence anything on the radio, anything on TV that's in the Chinese language, because the WeChat accounts are huge to promote any content. So it's not just WeChat, it's the whole information ecosystem. But if you look at specific cases, and the specific examples I can give from the United States is that I personally spoke to two candidates who were of a Chinese background in the United States, who were running for election. One of them basically could not post on WeChat at all because the party didn't like what the person was saying. Another one basically had been told that if they posted anything on WeChat, they could campaign off of WeChat, but anything on WeChat that would be against the party, she had family in China and she did not want to lose the ability to communicate or have them be threatened in any way. So if you have that as the backdrop, of course, it has enormous impact on what people are seeing on a regular basis.
Is there any suspicion that the Chinese government also uses other platforms like Facebook or Twitter X to mount disinformation campaigns or to otherwise control social media?
I mean, you could certainly see that. The big difference is It's in English. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of organizations, including the hosting company, that can monitor that, can take action against that. And because everything is in English, and because people have so many other sources of information, the ability to influence the readers or the people who are receiving the information, I would say, is much reduced. When the whole Chinese language information ecosystem, with WeChat at the center, but as well as the newspapers and as well as other media, are being influenced by the party, and you don't have many other options beyond that, you are really under the party's control.
Do you think that WeChat could face calls in the United States or Canada to change ownership? WeChat's owned by Tencent, which is an extremely powerful tech company, Chinese-based tech company. Could you imagine any value in calling for Tencent to release WeChat?
I think it's really hard the way Tencent organizes this platform for it to divest it. I think that would be really hard to do. So I think the more likely scenario is there has to be clear regulations, clear ways to monitor whether the regulations are being followed, and then clear implications for the company if they're not followed. And for me, that would likely mean that WeChat would have to be banned in the same way we talk currently of banning TikTok.
Global social media, though, right now, it's part of our town square, whether it comes from Palo Alto or Shenzhen. Do you think that that means that a certain baseline level of disinformation is something we're just going to have to assume now whenever we evaluate anything that's coming our way on social media platforms?
I think the big difference between, let's say, a Twitter and a WeChat is Twitter, there might be narratives you disagree with. There might be narratives that are a product of disinformation campaigns conducted by China or Russia or some other country. But I think the difference is on the Chinese language apps, the misinformation is the dominant source of information. Obviously, there's differences of opinions and we need differences of opinion, mm-hmm. but the level of content management is completely different. You're not talking about disinformation in an open platform. You're talking about content management in a closed platform. And we need to understand that it's completely different. And we're talking about completely different degrees of a problem.
Seth Kaplan, thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Seth Kaplan is a professorial lecturer at Johns Hopkins University.
Every time I survived a war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What?
Well, you're American, okay?
Okay. What kind of American are you?
That's from the new movie Civil War, which opened in theaters this week. And the guy asking that question, played by a menacing Jesse Plemons, is dressed in fatigues and has an assault rifle draped across his chest. Just to be clear, Civil War is fictional, though it may hit a little close to home after January 6th. The movie imagines an alliance between Texas and California that's working to overthrow the U.S. government. Civil War is the latest film by British director Alex Garland, whose previous movies include Ex Machina and Annihilation. It's getting a lot of buzz, but should you watch it? To answer that question, I'm joined by Dana Stevens. She's a film critic for Slate and a host of the Slate Culture Gabfest podcast. Dana, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Brent.
When I watched the trailer for Civil War, it reminded me of The Last of Us, but without zombies. Is that a fair comparison?
I mean, it's a very apt comparison in that Alex Garland, the writer-director of Civil War, got his start writing a very famous zombie movie. He wrote 28 Days Later, the Danny Boyle movie from back in the early 2000s, which was a kind of groundbreaking zombie movie. It was a different way of imagining zombies. You know, sort of the first fast zombies. It sort of turned them into video game antagonists. So, yeah, there is an element of genre in this new movie, Civil War. I mean, it's a political thriller. If you had to say what genre it is, it's a kind of dystopic political thriller.
Huh. But is it a war film? I mean, that's the genre that I'm interested in. The title says Civil War. Clearly, that's what the film is about. But is it?
Well, I mean, maybe it's useful to set up exactly what happens in Civil War. Civil War is, it's not set in any specified future, right? It's not one of those movies that starts with, you know, the year is 2028. It just throws us in medias res into this conflict in the U.S. that could be happening right now. The difference being that the political fractures in the America that Garland imagines are very different from the ones that have been fracturing this country since our real Civil War in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And that's all very deliberate. So when you see the trailer to this movie, which is everywhere, I've heard some snickers at the moment that the Texas-California Alliance is mentioned. And the fact is that although impossible to imagine along our current red state, blue state split, it is a very deliberate choice on Garland's part. He's trying to mess with political alliances so that this is not a simple extrapolation of where we are right now, but is a kind of an alternate American reality. And he's not really that interested in the specific politics that started the war. The president goes unnamed. His political party is never mentioned.
Right, but
there isn't any figure that resembles Trump. There isn't any figure that resembles Joe Biden. It isn't an attempt to sort of recreate our reality in a more dystopic vein, but to really imagine a different war so that we're not thinking about questions of red state, blue state.
But how does that sit with you? I mean, here's a film about a civil war that eliminates politics. Was that frustrating for you when you were watching the conflict and trying to figure it out?
I think by the end of the movie, it was frustrating. I mean, I understand what Garland is trying to do. For one thing, he's an Englishman, right? He's an outsider who's looking at America. And in that sense, I think he's trying to make a movie the way that an American Hollywood movie might look at a foreign war, right? If you think about the tradition of movies like The Year of Living Dangerously or A Private War was a more recent one that are about American correspondents or European correspondents abroad covering these foreign wars and kind of watching civilizations collapse into barbarity. I think he deliberately is trying to do that as an outsider looking in on the U.S., which doesn't frustrate me. I think that that's an interesting project. Where I start to get frustrated is that this movie remains so vague about what its particular political configuration is that not only are there no good guys and no bad guys, which is, you know, I think in an anti-war movie, a completely legitimate choice to make, but it isn't even clear in terms of the individual characters we're looking at, who are mostly journalists, this foursome of journalists who are trying to get through a dangerous war zone. It's not even clear what their moral choices are or whether those are good or bad. So in some ways, the ambivalence of this movie, the moral ambivalence, ends up, I think, undermining what it is actually trying to do and making somewhat fuzzy what Garland's project is.
Okay, so it's probably not a film about contemporary politics, about immigration or inequality or any of the other issues that are roiling the United States right now. But then when the four main characters are journalists, it makes me think he has something to say about journalism. Does he?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think I would say this is more a movie about journalism than it is a movie about politics. I mean, it's using a dystopic imagined political future of chaos as a way to ask questions about what a war correspondent is, you know, what a journalist's ethical responsibility is, you know, and sometimes in very concrete scenarios, like you're a photojournalist and you see someone being tortured, you know, a civilian being tortured by another civilian. Is it your job to photograph this and report it? Is it your job to somehow intervene? And there, too, I think things get fuzzy. I mean, this movie is visceral. Don't get me wrong. Like, you will feel things when you're watching it. You feel like you've been dropped into a war zone and your pulse rate will increase. And it's very effective on that level. It's on the level of thinking through the issues that the movie kind of fell down for me.
Okay. Well, but so it sounds like a muddled message there as well. The form of the movie is a road movie, and I've heard it compared to Apocalypse Now because it's a journey from New York to Washington, D.C. through this dystopic America. Did that work for you? Did that element pay off?
I mean, the road movie part of it is really well done. I will say this for Alex Garland. He can really pace a suspense scene. He can make a car chase very scary. The idea that they are finding their way, again, in a zombie movie sort of style, through this abandoned America, you know, where the highways are clogged with, you know, parked cars that people must have, you know, either run out of or been killed in or something. Mm-hmm. Like the setting is terrifying. And so the road movie part of it is, I think, really well done. And Apocalypse Now is an interesting reference. I think Garland is deliberately referencing it in one scene where the journalists come across this sort of abandoned Christmas attraction. And there's this very grotesque scene where various snipers are trying to shoot at each other. And one of the journalists, the reporter of the group, asks, what side are you on, basically? And nobody seems to know. And there's a very similar scene in Apocalypse Now, remember, where Martin Sheen asks somebody who's in command, and the kid says, isn't it you? There's that kind of a bitterly anti-war message of just the sheer chaos that's taken over the country.
Dana, what did you like about Civil War?
You know, I liked lots of things, despite all the negative things I've just said. And I don't think the movie completely works as a whole. I mean, I didn't walk out of it saying that movie nailed it, right? But I did walk out of it thinking and feeling a lot. And a huge part of that, I think, had to do with the performances. Garland's a really good director of actors, and in particular, Kirsten Dunst, who I guess you would say is the protagonist. She's sort of the main journalist we stay with. Really turns in an extraordinary performance in the kind of role you don't often see Kirsten Dunst in. You know, she's a very dour, glum, an obsessive photojournalist, I would say. You know, somebody whose whole life has narrowed down to the size of her camera lens. And again, you know, a morally ambivalent person. Like, she basically can't have any human relationships because of all the PTSD she's gone through as a lifelong war photographer. And she's extraordinary. The whole cast really is. And like I say, you will have an intense emotional and physical experience when you see this movie. Whether you will have a satisfying intellectual experience is another question.
Okay. So taking into consideration the things you liked, the things you didn't like, what would you say to someone who's thinking of seeing the film this weekend? Should they watch it?
I think I would say yes with a little bit of a content warning. I think that if you're someone who can tolerate a fair amount of graphic violence and, you know, really intense suspense scenes, and you're really interested in seeing our current political situation sort of extrapolated into a bizarre alternate reality, if those two things interest you, I think you would get a lot out of seeing this movie and have a really interesting discussion afterwards with whoever you see it with.
Dana Stevens, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dana Stevens is a film critic for Slate and a host of the Slate Culture Gabfest podcast. Still to come on Day 6, Riff from the Headlines, our weekly quiz, and your chance to bag a bag. Stay tuned.
Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 from CBC Radio. We're on public radio stations across the United States. You can listen on demand with the CBC Listen app, and we're available wherever you get your podcasts and at cbc.ca/day6.
We're sitting on the couch. She's looking into my eyes and says, hey, you want to hear one of my new songs? She starts singing, and this velvet voice comes out. Unbelievable. I just fell in love with her right then. I mean, it was like magic.
I miss the sweet love of the air. A silver chariot soars through Mercury ripples of sky.
That velvet voice belonged to Judy Sill. And if you've never heard of her, you're not alone.
There are so many musicians who are way more talented than I'll ever be. And I often wonder, you know, why not them and why me, you know? I have a feeling that the darker side of Judy's life was what stopped her going to whatever the next level was.
That's Graham Nash. He is one of the musicians in a new documentary about Judy Sill. Judy was a singer-songwriter in the early 1970s, and her songs were unlike anything anyone else was writing and performing. In 1971, she became the first artist to sign with Asylum Records, the new music label headed by David Geffen. She acknowledged from the start that she struggled with drug addiction, but she also said that she wanted to be famous. Really famous. And in a 2-year span, she went from living in a car to being on the cover of Rolling Stone. But by the mid-1970s, her career stalled. And in 1979, she died of an overdose. Her obit wasn't even published. But despite that, over the years, her influence has grown, and it's still reverberating in musicians today. Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom are the directors of Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. Andy, Brian, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you.
In the course of making this film, how many times have you heard people say that they had never heard of Judy Sill?
9 out of 10 times.
And how did the two of you learn about her, Andy?
I heard about her first from an interview Andy Partridge of the band XCC gave around the year 2000 and about the influence she had on his work. And I checked her out probably on Napster. None of her albums were in print, so they were probably bootlegs. And then soon after YouTube started, a video of her performing the song The Kiss on the Old Grey Whistle Test appeared. And it just slayed me. It really just had a very profound effect on me. And pretty much anybody who watches that video will either feel blown away by it or, you know, they'll say, oh, that's really nice. And I knew Brian would have the blown away reaction. So I showed it to him soon afterwards. And Brian, do you want to take over?
It completely blew me away, as Andy predicted it would. And we started to talk about the possibility of making a film about her. We didn't really know much about her life. And the more we researched it, the more we felt like, wow, this is a really interesting person. And we want to share her story with a wider audience in the hopes that maybe more people would be drawn to her music, which, you know, she claimed she was making to heal people. And I really believe, and I think Andy believes too, that her music does have that impact. And that was really our motivation in making the film.
I was really taken by that aspect of the film as well, that she believed her music was a tool for transcendence. But that music, I mean, it's impossible not to have the emotional reaction that you had, but the way that musicians talk about it as well. I mean, her music is complex. It is sophisticated. The skills that she has in her arrangement and composition are remarkable. And I just want to share with the listeners how she described her music. She said it is occult, holy Western, Baroque gospel. So when people ask you about Judy's music, Brian, how do you describe it?
Well, you know, words kind of escape me because it hits something both kind of ancient and new in us that we are almost unaware of until we hear Judy pointed out to us. And I've never played Judy's music for anyone who wasn't, you know, just completely blown away and kind of gobsmacked by her talent, and not only her talent, but her depth.
Mm-hmm. Her greatest influences, she said, were Bach, Ray Charles, and Pythagoras. and maybe Aretha, she would have thrown that in there too, her piano playing. You know, I've met a lot of musicians since we've made the film who know a lot more about music than I do, and they describe, just as you just did, the depth of it and this sort of how much she has going on, interweaving in and out. And it's a sort of music class they're taking, listening to her work.
Yeah. And the musicians that speak about her in the film, the ones that knew her, the lineup of people that you have talking about her, including Graham Nash and David Geffen, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Sean Colvin, David Crosby, who died in January. Andy, how willing were people to be a part of this doc and some of them talking about Judy, who they knew intimately?
They were grateful and thrilled that Judy was finally getting her due. And that was across the board. There was nobody, everybody just felt it's about time. And we were very fortunate that, you know, that was the attitude because it allowed us to, it inspired us. It motivated us to keep going. The film took 10 years to make, partly, you know, we, in terms of getting all the interviews, but also just acquiring the archival material. And it didn't all come at once. And it took a while.
It's interesting. You said it's about time. And why wasn't her time the time? She says many times in the film that she wants to be famous. She says as famous as a person can be. And it never happened for her. She was not successful commercially. Why do you think, Andy, that this beautiful music did not resonate with the wider audience?
I think it's complicated music. It's not something that you can just listen to and make sense of necessarily. It takes some repeated listenings and then it opens up and its depth is revealed. I think that there were a lot of the tastes of the music at the time lent itself more to bands like Crosby, Stills and Nash or the Eagles, and nothing against those bands, but just that was those bands or Jackson Browne. That was just what people's tastes were. I think her music is a little more complex, but I also think it's more timeless in some ways, personal opinion. And so it's not a surprise to me now that she's arguably more well-known now than she was in her lifetime.
But Brian, what did the lack of commercial success mean for her in terms of, you know, the troubled life that she led?
I think it was a really bitter pill for Judy to swallow, especially after she poured just her heart and soul into her, I would argue, masterpiece of an album, Heart Food.
That was her second album.
Her second album, and then to, you know, have that actually sell less copies than the first album, I think it's just really devastating for her. And especially, you know, if you put yourself in Judy's head, and she's, you know, really here on earth to help heal people through her music, and she feels like she has something that will help the masses, and then the masses don't come. You know, I think that was a really hard thing for her that would, combined with her childhood trauma and her disease of addiction, just really created a very difficult situation.
And some really lousy luck as well, because she got in a car accident and had serious back problems that got her back on hard drugs in the mid-70s.
No, I mean, her demons are considerable. There was trauma from her upbringing. Then there was drug addiction. There was the, you know, she led a life of illegal activity, committing robberies. She was involved in sex work. But the other thing that's unusual about her music for that time especially is how much she seems to connect it to God and spirituality. And it's connected in an extremely unconventional way. She talks about spirituality. She ties it to sexuality. But do you think, Andy, that she ever found God, or that she ever found the support that she sought out in religion, or that if it was manifested in her music in the way that she wanted it to be?
Well, I think she felt that she was channeling a higher power in creating her music. I think her search for a religion that she could commit herself to never ended. At the end of her life, she was trying Islam. She tried Buddhism. Linda Ronstadt talks about where she was a Rosicrucian.
Right.
I don't think that ever ended. And I do think it was connected to her sense of mission, or what she thought her mission was, which was create music that healed people. So I think she was very serious about that. But I wouldn't label her a Christian artist. Jesus Was a Crossmaker is not about Jesus. It's about J.D. Souther. Right. Whereas the song My Man on Love is not about a lover, but is about Jesus. So it's a little hard to pin her down.
No, it absolutely. I mean, it's hard to pin her down in everything. And yet there's just so much there. There's so much going on. In the film, Graham Nash says, Brian, that there are so many people more talented than he is, and that he wonders why he achieved success and that they didn't. Do you think that the lack of success tormented Judy Sill until the end?
Well, I do and I don't. You know, Vicki Randall, who took care of Judy when she was in a full body cast, just talks about how Judy didn't seem to have a lot of self-pity. She just felt like, you know, this was something she had to go through in life, and she was going through it. And I wonder if at times she felt the same way about the lack of success, you know, in the music world. You know, one thing I'm hoping that the film does is maybe challenge us all to kind of reevaluate what is our perception or definition of making it. I mean, it's hard for me to listen to The Kiss and think on any level that Judy didn't, you know, quote, make it, you know.
Right.
It's just such an extraordinary song. And you know, and then the redemption for Judy is that there is this new generation of younger singer-songwriters who are discovering her in the last decade and lifting her music up. What do you think they're hearing in Judy Sill now that people at the time couldn't grasp?
I think it's, for those musicians, I think it's about the mission that Judy was on of what music can do and the power of music has. And she encompasses, she's an inspiration for musicians who aspire to that. And there's a spiritual quality to her work that is as close to religion as some people might get. Music perhaps is as close to religion as some people get. And to me, she encompasses that aspect of music. And then you can, then there's of course all the complex musical chops that she exhibits, and that is just awe-inspiring to musicians. You know, she learned how to chart her own songs, was conducting the orchestra of her second album, Heart Food. You know, these are things that most pop musicians don't know how to do. So, and those sounds are all interwoven in a complex way in her songs. So I think musicians are just kind of in awe of that.
I also think that her message, like for me personally, is one of, you know, these things that we're looking for to give life meaning are really already deep inside us, and it's our job to kind of uncover them. Mm. And I think there's something really positive about that message, and people respond to it.
Mm. Andy and Brian, it's a remarkable story. Thank you very much for talking to us today, and best of luck with the film.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Appreciate it.
It's great.
Andy Brown and Brian Lindstrom are the directors of Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. The documentary opened in selected theaters yesterday. It's also available on demand.
While you sit and seek a crescent, moon is laying at your feet. We'll hope that's made of sand. You don't think you can, but you have held it all in.
The headlines.
And here we are with Riff from the Headlines, our weekly quiz. Three riffs linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the riffs, you could win a Day 6 tote bag. First, here's a recap. This is last week's clue. PSC with Final Four, Men and Women by NXS, and North Carolina by Little Chief, and Riley Finn of Vancouver correctly guessed the headline that we're looking for. North Carolina State men's and women's basketball teams both advanced to the Final Four, and that's where they peaked. Congratulations, Riley. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. Now, here's this week's clue.
Here on Gilligan's Island. So this is the tale of our castaways. They're here for a long, long time. They'll have to make the best of things. It's an uphill climb.
Help! I need somebody.
Help!
Not just anybody.
Help!
You know I need someone.
We're looking for the story that connects those riffs. Email us your answer, put riff from the headlines in the subject, and send it to day6@cbc.ca. Please include your mailing address. One right answer will be picked at random. The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. You can always hear the clues again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
time, weather, and
from the headlines.
And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley-Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott. Our intern is Sandrine Jacot. And I'm Brent Bambury. It's 2 days to the start of Donald Trump's criminal trial, 3 days to the federal budget, and 7 days till we meet again on day 6.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.